The third case for oral argument this morning is Donald Buckland Construction Appellant versus McCormick Construction Appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Ronald Parsons, Jr. and Ms. Pam Bolwig, attorneys from Sioux Falls. Mr. Parsons, I understand you'll be presenting this morning?
Yes, sir.
Very well. And for the appellee, we have Mr. Matthew Bach, an attorney from Sioux Falls.
Yes, sir.
Correct. Justice Wilbur has disqualified herself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Randall Macy, the circuit judge from the 4th Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Wilbur's place. With that, Mr. Parsons, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Mr. Bach. There's little in the law that has greater importance than the assurance that attorneys give their clients that their cases will be decided on the merits, that they will be given the opportunity to present their best case and then let the chips fall where they may. In fact, most of our procedures are crafted to ensure that a litigant will be given the opportunity to be heard, often or even usually in this case, by a jury. So the purpose of procedure is to ensure that disputed cases are resolved on the merits. And it's our position that that did not happen here in contravention of proper procedure and correct application of the law under the circumstances. So we're asking this court to reverse a default judgment and a summary judgment granted in a pair of cases involving the construction of concrete grain storage facilities. And we're asking this court remand these cases so that they can be decided in and meet their destiny in the arena where they belong, which is the courtroom. The facts are fairly simple here. Mr. Buckland, his company, filed these two actions seeking to be paid for work that he performed on these concrete grain storage buildings. And McCormick filed a counterclaim, and there's a serious dispute, factual dispute, expert dispute eventually, what there will be, we hope, about whose fault it was that these buildings failed, whether or not Mr. Buckland was entitled to be paid more, whether he was justified in ceasing work, and who was responsible for various faults in these buildings that ended up occurring. McCormick counterclaimed, as I said, based on that, and Buckland never filed the answers, at least not until much later, to those counterclaims, the replies. He was represented at that time by a North Dakota attorney named James Lester, and he was inadvertently neglected to file them. He was engaged in other parts of the litigation at the time, but in other words, he was not. There was nothing that physically prevented him from doing it, as we've acknowledged. That was in the early fall of 2011. The case then began, was litigated after that. We had two attorneys, and actually we had two law firms on each side, one from Minnesota, one from North Dakota, and local counsel for both. The case was litigated, and there were other parties at the beginning. There was the South Dakota Wheat Growers Association, and there were motions to dismiss involving those claims. Those were litigated. The original claims were litigated of unjust enrichment and mechanics liens. They were dismissed. There was a motion for summary judgment that was initially filed by McCormick on the remaining unjust enrichment claim. And then the parties negotiated a stipulation that there would be an amended complaint. We filed a motion to amend our complaint, or Mr. Lester did at that time. And there were, that was stipulated that we could bring a breach of contract action. That happened over the course of about 5, 6, 7, 8 months. During that time, there were also negotiations between the parties, at least attempted negotiations, discussions about what would be done with this building, communications between the attorneys. There was never a point where there was not contact between these lawyers about this case. But the following spring or early summer in June of 2012, McCormick then, which had been gathering information about its damages, as it claimed damages as it should have been, decided, well, at some point it realized that these replies had never been filed. We don't know if they realized it right away and kept it in their pocket, or if they realized it in June of 2012 and said, aha.
Had the replies been served on opposing counsel?
Not at that time, no. Originally, no.
They just were never done.
That's right.
All right.
That's right. So they were never filed, never served. And so in June we had the default motion and a summary judgment motion. And like I said, we don't know when they discovered it, but they discovered it. When that was filed, our Mr. Lester, still representing the Buckland at that time, he arranged for a continuance of an original hearing that was set, which was stipulated to. He filed the replies and served them. He filed a motion to enlarge the time to serve them. And a summary judgment motion was also filed at that time on the Buckland's claims against McCormick. He served at that time, just before the hearing, his response to that, including affidavits and the response to the statement of material facts. The trial court granted the default judgment and the summary judgment. It granted the default judgment stating that, well, I don't see anything. It just wasn't done. I don't see an excuse. And that's really as far as it went, the ruling. It was just an oral ruling. There was no decision made. And the same for the summary judgment. It said, well, I don't see any disputed facts. And that's about it that was ruled upon at this oral dismissal of this case, in essence, although damages were reserved. Immediately, Mr. Buckland fired Mr. Lester, retained new counsel, and immediately motions to vacate the default judgment were filed in the summary judgment under Rule 55A and 55C and 60B, which was incorporated by 55C. Another hearing was held. The evidence was presented again. New affidavits showing disputed facts about both counterclaims and the claims. At least a prima facie case that a better result could be obtained than a default judgment, which is the standard under the law. But the trial court denied the motions to vacate, to enlarge, to reconsider, and so the case was essentially ended, other than discovery on damages and an eventual hearing on damages, until this court granted the present intermediate appeal. We suggest that it was error at each stage not to let this case go forward on the merits. It was error not to grant the default judgment initially, where the parties had been engaged in defending the litigation and in contact with each other. Certainly, though, it was a default to or error not to grant the motions to vacate those judgments, we contend. And also, we contend it was error to grant summary judgment under this court's
ruling. We have to find error in all those things in order for you to prevail?
No, I think just under one. If we prevail at any stage, I think we would be sent back and we'd litigate this case as we think should happen.
Would that include the initial grant of the default?
Yes, I do think that we've appealed from the initial grant, and I think that should be vacated. If not, then the denial of our motion to vacate should be reversed. These statutes interlock and the law interlocks with these because there are different stages when you're talking about a default. There's the initial failure to plead or otherwise defend. And the statutes there really don't incorporate a standard. The court has applied standards to that initial decision. But the statute itself just says if there's a failure to plead or otherwise defend, then there may be a default. And so it's our contention that the standards that apply to vacating default judgments aren't necessarily always incorporated into that initial decision. Initially, default judgments typically only happen when there's not an appearance, where someone has not in contact. They've been served, but they haven't made any appearance at all. And that's when default judgments are usually granted initially. And then usually someone swoops in, and then you have a motion to vacate that initial default judgment. But at the initial stage, I couldn't find a case where someone is here litigating, engaged in hearings and motions, and nonetheless an initial default is granted for failing to plead or otherwise defend. That just really doesn't happen. Not to say it couldn't, but the Tingle case was the best case that they found, and there it was a situation in which someone, a corporation, had been served, but then they spent the next 4 months ignoring the lawsuit and never hired a lawyer until right before a trial, I think. And there, default was ultimately upheld, I think. But so we think it was error to grant it to begin with, where we have an attorney, we have pleadings, we have filed pleadings, an appearance. We think that was wrong. But once that happened, then the motion to vacate, then we have a set of concrete, more concrete standards. And there we go on to Rule 55A and 55C and 60B. And there the express reasons that under 60B that are incorporated that default judgment can be vacated is mistake, inadvertence, surprise, or excusable neglect. And so we contended that this was an inadvertence, certainly, is what was argued at the hearing to vacate it, or excusable neglect. And so clearly this was not something that was done intentionally or was done recklessly, knowingly. I mean, that's what I'm getting at. This is not something that was knowingly done. This was something that was inadvertently done. Mr. Lester was surprised to discover he had failed to do this. So we think we clearly satisfy the mistake and inadvertence and even excusable neglect. And excusable neglect also incorporates the duty of a client to keep on top of his case, but it also makes clear that you don't impute mistakes like this irrevocably to a client where a lawyer has made the mistake. I mean, that there are cases that this court has decided that are right on point on that. And so we think we've satisfied the inadvertence, mistake, and excusable neglect elements of the test, and that default judgment either should not have been granted or should have been vacated when it was very promptly sought to be done.
Mr. Parsons, how do you respond to what I'm sure Mr. Bach will talk about as, okay, this isn't excusable neglect because the attorney, the only thing he said was he was busy. And looking at the affidavits, he really didn't fill that out very much.
Yeah, I mean, that's the story is he didn't realize he didn't do it. I mean, that's the whole story. He didn't realize he forgot to do that. It was inadvertent. So I think that's inadvertence under that prong, but it's excusable neglect also because this court, when it's talking about excusable neglect, it's made clear how disfavored default judgment is. I mean, this is not how we decide cases. We want them to be decided if at all possible. And this court has said in addressing the excusable neglect standard that default should only be granted when the adversary process has been halted because of an essentially unresponsive party. So that's excusable neglect incorporates that requirement. And even willful defaults are sometimes vacated when you say, I'm just not going to answer. But if the position is so strong on the merits, this court has even allowed a willful default to be reconsidered. So that's the response. I mean, I can't make what Mr. Lester did look good. He forgot to file these replies, and that should never have happened. But the punishment needs to fit the crime. And our court favors making these determinations, resolving particularly complex cases on the merits, and we believe that should be done here. And we do believe we've set forth a meritorious defense as well. A prima facie case, obviously we don't have discovery, but we've set forth an affidavit form why we believe we're entitled to recover from McCormick and it's in the millions of dollars we believe we're entitled to. It's hotly disputed, obviously. So we believe that default judgment should be vacated. Finally, the summary judgment motion or grant of summary judgment we also believe should be vacated. That's something this court reviews de novo, and it can't be granted if there are disputed facts in the record. The trial court, again, essentially just gave an oral summary judgment ruling, which is unusual. And just said, well, I don't see any disputed facts regarding breach or damages, and so I'm granting summary judgment too. And he kind of bootstrapped in the order that followed the default judgment on the counterclaims into its summary judgment ruling. No statement of facts or summary of facts of what the material facts were by the trial court. No mention of the law or a single case, nothing. I mean, he mentioned what the claim was. He said it was a breach of contract claim, and that's about it. Problem is, there was evidence in the record that disputed the summary judgment motion filed by McCormick. Now, it had been filed before the hearing, just before the hearing, the day before the hearing, but it had been filed. And the trial court never made any finding that it was untimely. There was never any analysis of that. And on appeal, McCormick has not argued it was untimely. Instead, McCormick has said, well, the facts aren't really truly all that disputed if you go into them deeply. But that, I would suggest, is what the trial process is for. Each point that was made in the summary judgment motion, statement of material facts, was responded to in a filed document. And that's what the rule says. It just says it has to be filed. And the response must be filed, otherwise it's deemed admitted. And these were filed before the hearing. Each point is responded to and supported either by the documents put into the record by McCormick in its initial motion or with Mr. Buckland's own affidavit. And so we contend that the drastic remedy of summary judgment was improperly granted and should be reversed as well.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Mr. Bach, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court. I'm Matt Bach with the Woods Fuller Law Firm in Sioux Falls. I'm privileged here to be here today to represent McC. Mark Schmidt, the CFO of McC, is here as well, asking that you affirm the trial court's decision in its grant of a default judgment in McC's favor and affirm the decision to deny Mr. Buckland's motion to enlarge the time to answer and his motion to vacate the default judgment. In addition, McC asks that you affirm the grant of summary judgment in its favor against Mr. Buckland on his breach of contract claim. McC acknowledges, and as Mr. Parsons pointed out again this morning, this court and South Dakota courts in general do not favor judgments by default, and they have a preference for trial on the merits. But that preference is viewed through a particular framework, and that framework includes if you don't answer in time, you have to prove excusable neglect, either your agent's excusable neglect or your own excusable neglect. You have to prove that you had a meritorious defense, that is, that you would have received a more favorable judgment below if you reverse this case. And you have to consider this decision as to how it will promote justice. And there's two parties to every case, and justice is considered for both parties, not just Mr. Buckland, but we also have to consider how this case affects McCormick. So if we look at the different decisions that were made by the trial court judge, the first decision was to grant a default judgment. And the rule states you must answer or otherwise defend within 20 days. There's a time limitation there. So these counterclaims were served back in September. In October, McC moved to dismiss Donald Buckland's mechanics liens from the real estate records. His time to answer the counterclaims at the time, you know, it's a month later, had expired. Immediately before the motion to dismiss the mechanics liens claim, Mr. Holper, McC's Minneapolis counsel, wrote to Mr. Buckland's counsel stating, hey, we had some discussions this summer after you filed your lawsuit. We wrote you some letters regarding these claims. In addition to that, we filed counterclaims. We would like an immediate response to all of those letters and counterclaims. And that's in the appendix at page 50. In our appendix at page 50, you can look at that letter, and it's the third page of the letter, and it says, I wrote you a couple letters, we've got some counterclaims out there, an immediate response to the foregoing is requested. So after the time for a default judgment, you know, almost a day or so after the time for default judgment, McC notified Mr. Buckland that he had failed to respond to the counterclaims. Mr. Buckland ignored that letter. We never got a response in writing, no email, no phone call in response to that, and certainly we didn't have an answer filed. Because the mechanics liens were insufficiently itemized, the trial court judge dismissed those liens and removed them from the real estate records. So at that point, a day after his answer's due, or a couple days after his answer's due, Mr. Buckland is on notice that we've got serious issues with his itemization regarding the amount of damages he's claiming in his lawsuit, the lack of any change orders with respect to his lawsuit, and the fact that we have issues with respect to his claim for damages on a conveyor. He's on notice of all these things shortly after that. The next thing that happens is Mr. Buckland no longer has a claim against South Dakota wheat growers. So there's not any negotiation here. It's South Dakota wheat growers gives Buckland, Mr. Buckland, a choice. It says you can either face a summary judgment motion or you can stipulate to our dismissal. He stipulates to dismissal. This is not active litigation on Mr. Buckland's part. It's his realization that he no longer has a claim against the South Dakota wheat growers. So at the time the judge enters the default judgment, 20 days had passed, and because he's represented by counsel, because he had appeared, there's an additional requirement. McSee had to provide 3 days' notice prior to the default judgment hearing that they were seeking a default. So the only timeliness requirement was met. We provided notice. We went above and beyond that in providing the letter shortly after the time that the default could have occurred. But all notice requirements were met. And so when we're examining this issue, we have to look through an abuse of discretion lens. And that is, did the judge abuse its discretion in granting this default judgment? The judge followed the law. 20 days had passed, no answer had been filed, and 3 days' notice was given prior to the default judgment motion. The judge cannot be said to have abused his discretion. He followed the law when he entered the default judgment. After the default judgment is entered,
What the statutory requirement is failure to answer or otherwise defend? And it just seems like, I mean, they were defending the litigation. There was lots of stuff going on. And it just seems hard for me. It's hard for me to see or to say that Buckland was not defending the case.
I understand, Your Honor. There was a lot going on, but it was all at the behest of McSee or the South Dakota wheat growers. And we've got to remember here, there are two different cases. There is Donald Buckland's case against McSee. So if we want to talk about a defense, it was McSee defending against Mr. Buckland's claims. Donald Buckland filed mechanics liens. Its owner and its owner's bank, the property owner's bank, required that we defend those liens. McSee defended against those liens. South Dakota wheat growers asked to be out of the lawsuit. That's, again, Mr. Buckland's claim. It's not a defense to McSee's counterclaims. So he got out of the lawsuit. McSee moved for summary judgment on Mr. Buckland's unjust enrichment claim. Again, Mr. Buckland's claim, not McSee's claim. He stipulated to the dismissal of that claim, recognizing he didn't have an unjust enrichment claim. McSee allowed him to amend his complaint and seek a breach of contract action. So everything Mr. Buckland did was at the behest of McSee or South Dakota wheat growers. There wasn't any active participation. If we want to talk about a defense to McSee's claims, that is, he didn't pay his subcontractors, he didn't complete the buildings, and there were construction defects, there's no evidence of the record of any defense offered. There's no writing saying, no, I completed the buildings. In fact, his affidavit says, I walked off the job. I didn't pay my subcontractors. So as to a defense to McSee's counterclaims, nothing was done. All that was done was the bare minimum to keep his claim alive. He did nothing to defend against McSee's claim. So prior to the default judgment motion, Mr. Lester, on behalf of Mr. Buckland, had moved to enlarge the time to answer. After he recognized that when he submitted his initial answer, he had not requested that relief. And he's required to request that relief when he does not submit an initial answer after 20 days of service. The court denied that motion to enlarge time. Again, we've got to look at this through the abuse of discretion framework. Did the court abuse its discretion? Could any other judge in this state have found the same way that this judge did? And I say the answer is yes. At the hearing on the motion to enlarge time, one excuse was offered. That was, Mr. Lesser was just too busy to handle this lawsuit. Mr. Buckland didn't offer any excuse in writing as to why the answer couldn't be filed. So the claim that the judge didn't analyze Mr. Buckland's negligence, none was offered. No meritorious defense was offered. The only excuse, and even if it was, the only excuse offered was that the lawyer was too busy. And that's not excusable neglect. So at the time the judge denied the motion to enlarge time to answer, he examined the excuse offered, determined that that did not satisfy the stringent requirement of excusable neglect, and denied the motion to enlarge time. Now keep in mind, prior to the time this motion to enlarge time was filed, and prior to the time the answer was filed, McSee notified Mr. Buckland of the default on June 27th. 21 days pass before an answer even gets filed. So this is twice now he's missed a 20-day requirement to file an answer. Nothing done to defend this. And the only excuse for getting late paperwork in offered at the hearing on the motion to enlarge time and the motion for default judgment, the only excuse offered on behalf of Mr. Buckland was that he was drumming up business in South Carolina. That's not good enough. You've got a lawsuit going in South Dakota here. You've got to tend to that lawsuit. So he did not offer any excusable neglect.
Was there anything offered to the trial judge in this as to a prejudice to your client by granting the extension of time or by denying the motion for default?
Not at this proceeding, Your Honor, but at the next proceeding, which was the motion to vacate the default judgment filed by Mr. Buckland, the prejudice offered by McSee was that it had completed the work that Buckland was supposed to complete, and it notified Mr. Buckland that they were going to do that and asked, hey, do you want to come out here and help with this? It had paid off the subcontractor's liens that were filed on the real estate records, and it's not McSee's subcontractors, it's Mr. Buckland's subcontractors. He had plenty of time to go down to the Register of Deeds office and examine those if he had any problem. One of the subcontractor's liens stated, hey, you've got some of my equipment, Mr. Buckland. If you return that equipment, I'll reduce the amount of my lien. We asked, hey, will you return the equipment to reduce the amount of the lien? McSee was ignored. McSee was doing all these things, completing the buildings. We were put on notice by the owner's insurance company of potential grain loss, so we had to go out and complete the roof. There were safety concerns given the structure, so we were out there completing, repairing, and paying off subcontractor liens to get the project done. In addition to that, the other evidence of prejudice was that Mr. Buckland's a serial defaulter. His litigation history from the late 90s to now shows that he had over 17 default judgments entered against him. And coincidentally, if you look at the largest default judgment that was entered in 2001, over $600,000, that was satisfied in August of 2010, right about the time he was taking large payments from McSee. So we've got a history here of default judgment, of ignoring litigation, and to get in line behind those other creditors was additional prejudice offered at the hearing regarding the motion to vacate the default judgment. But again, the first step before we even get to prejudice is to look at, was there any excusable neglect?
Let me stop you there. Go back to prejudice just for a minute. Until you have a judgment for an amount, do you really have judgment lien priority?
No, Your Honor, and that's the prejudice here, is that we need to be able to proceed with our case in a timely manner. There's two phases to every case, liability and damages. And in this case, there's only a judgment on liability. So Mr. Buckland's going to get his day in court with respect to damages. And most of his defenses offered in his affidavit relate to damages, relate to whether the concrete was his fault or somebody else's fault, relate to whether the structure's sound based on the steel he used, relate to the capacity of the grain bins. That all relates to damages, not liability. With respect to liability, we've got a couple of things. I walked off the project and I didn't pay my subcontractors. And his excuse for that is, I wasn't getting paid. But guess what? We have a contract. The contract says if you feel like you aren't getting paid, there's a procedure you follow. You've got to give us notice. You can't just walk off the job. Mr. Buckland doesn't even argue that he used the contractual mechanism to get off the project. He just says, I abandoned and I didn't pay my subcontractors. And if we go back to the motion to vacate the summary judgment or the default judgment, we look at the excusable neglect offered. And again, Mr. Lester, incredibly, in the literal sense of the word, changes the story. Now it's not that I was too busy. It's that I forgot to calendar a deadline. Still not excusable neglect. This time, however, Mr. Buckland argues that, well, you can't impute Mr. Lester's negligence on me. And the South Dakota Supreme Court has been very clear that when you rely on an agent, that negligence of the agent is imputable to you. Unless, by clear affirmative proof, and this is from Smith v. Wordman, it's been around a long time since the 1930s, by clear affirmative proof, you can show that you yourself, the client, Mr. Buckland in this case, was free from any neglect himself. Mr. Buckland tried to meet that standard, but he failed. He put in an affidavit that stated, I called my lawyer. I responded to requests for information, and I relied completely on my lawyer to file any answers. That's not clear affirmative proof of diligence in defending a case in which over $3 million in damages are sought. It's just not enough. And if we look at cases in which Rule 60B relief has been granted, we start to see a theme. Now, we know there's a preference for trial on the merits, but when we grant Rule 60B relief, we also say that only occurs in extraordinary circumstances. And let's look at some of those extraordinary circumstances. We have the Geyer case. The individual had mental and physical infirmities that prevented her from answering. We have the Clark v. Clark case, in which there was infidelity involved in a marriage, an assurance from a husband that he was going to provide for the spouse, and an alcohol problem from the spouse. We said that's an extraordinary circumstance. We have L.A. v. Cartwright. That's a contractor, just like Mr. Buckland. In that case, his secretary lost her husband. The papers got thrown under his stack. He was overworked because one of his competitors went out of business. He was working from 3 a.m. to 10 p.m. at one point. He was having trouble at home. His children had left the home. His wife wasn't taking that well, and his daughter was ill. Those are the types of extraordinary circumstances in which this case has said, yes, you, the plaintiff, have shown excusable neglect for failing to answer. The other cases in which extraordinary remedies under 60B has been granted are when there's a failure of notice. Meyer v. McCord, Rosso v. Hennen, there was a party that made an appearance, an insurance company in both cases, that didn't get notice. Okay, if you fail to provide notice, Rule 60B relief is warranted. In this case, there's no notice issue. Instead, like Tingle, we have a party that sat idly on their rights for 8 to 10 months and didn't do anything until the very last minute. Mr. Buckland relied heavily on EB in his brief, which is an insurance case, not a reliance on a lawyer case. The difference in EB is that when you hand your defense over to an insurance company, they have a contractual obligation to defend you. And under contract, you don't have anything to say about that defense for the most part. They get to hire the lawyer. They get to settle the case. EB is a much different case than when a private citizen hires their own lawyer. The private citizen's driving the case. And if you want to rely on an insurance case, look at Strutton. Strutton's an insurance case in which the defendant, the third-party defendant, handed its defense over to its insurance company. It even, like Mr. Buckland, called its insurance agent a couple of times saying, what's going on? It still got defaulted because it didn't do enough to defend itself, even though it had relied on its agent.
All right. And can we go to the summary judgment before we run out of time here?
Yes, Your Honor.
In this case, trial court again granted summary judgment, and I believe if I'm not mistaken, he said, well, I must grant the summary judgment. There's no fact issues presented, but there was an affidavit that was presented with factual issues, was there not? You may not agree with them, but it was in there.
You're right, Your Honor. There was an affidavit presented by Mr. Buckland, again, a day before the hearing, but we can't be buffaloed by the stack of paper. We've got to look at the specific issues, and there are two cases here. There's a default judgment in which construction defects are claimed by M. McSee against Mr. Buckland. A lot of his defenses and a lot of the disputed facts relate to that construction defect. If we look at Mr. Buckland's entitlement to be paid money, that's all he's asking for. He's asking for money. So he has to show he's entitled to the money, and that, you know, if McSee breached, that he was damaged by that breach. So for an entitlement of money case, there are really only three facts offered in his affidavit. The first fact is, I wasn't paid my total contract amount. And again, this is in the appendix from pages 79 to 81. This is Mr. Buckland's affidavit. He does the math, but doesn't show his work. So I wasn't paid $2.1 million on each contract, which was my contract amount. The only evidence regarding an entitlement of payment are the invoices that were submitted with his mechanics liens and the invoices that were submitted with his first complaint. The mechanics lien had been dismissed, and the amended complaint, or the first complaint, was dropped. But if we look at those invoices, and those are in the record, in the first record, pages 13 through 18, and they're duplicated at 45 through 50, and in the second record, 25 through 40, and 67 through 82, if you look through those invoices, the only evidence of an entitlement to payment, it's nowhere close to $2.1 million. Buckland has the affirmative duty to prove he's entitled to $2.1 million. His invoices don't total that amount. He admits he was paid $2.8 million on this project. It's about the amount of the invoices. There's no evidence from which we could say, based on Buckland's affidavit and the documentary evidence in the record, that he was entitled to $2.1 million on each contract. It's just not there. There's no schedule of values. There's no additional invoices, nothing. The second claim for a payment of money is on change orders. The appendix, page 86, has the contractual provision which says change orders must be in writing. Now, right when the mechanics liens were dismissed, Buckland was on notice that there weren't any change orders. He's had 8 months to present a written change order. After the time the contract was signed, there does not exist within the record a single change order. No written change order. There's not even any evidence of an oral change order. There's just nothing there that would entitle him to payment on a change order. They don't exist. His final claim for breach and damages is that he paid $100,000 to a conveyor manufacturer that he wasn't supposed to pay, and in his words, he got stiffed on that payment by McSee. For the first time, we've got documentary evidence of the payment presented by Mr. Buckland. He points us to our appendix, page 104, which is a letter from the conveyor manufacturer acknowledging payment of not $100,000, but $48,000. The conveyor manufacturer says, Mr. Buckland, you paid me $23,000 down on each conveyor for or about 24, so a total of $48,000. If we look further into the record, so he never paid $100,000. It's not in the record. And his own evidence says he only paid $48,000. Then if we look back to his invoices, which are undisputed, were paid. The invoices don't total 2.1. We know McSee paid the invoices. If we look at invoice on record 1, page 15, and record 2, page 27, we see that Mr. Buckland charged through those conveyors.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Parsons, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, we just heard a wonderful jury argument, and McCormick's counsel is definitely prepared to try this case. I'm confident of that. But those elements are each, every argument that was made has a response that would take an hour to 2 hours to present. But they were presented, in essence, in Mr. Buckland's affidavits, both opposing the initial default judgment and opposing summary judgment. The complicated nature of the arguments that you just heard underlie the error that the judge made. The judge, in this case, the trial court, didn't make any of these findings, didn't make any of these conclusions, didn't examine any of these arguments. The judge said, well, I don't see any disputed facts, so I'm granting summary judgment. And that's all he said. That was error, and that should be reversed. There are a multitude of disputed facts regarding who is owed what in this complex construction litigation, and it will take a couple of weeks before a jury to sort those out. I would suggest, and I ask that the court allow that process to proceed. I do just want to say regarding Mr. Holper's letter that's been advocated as being a call to respond to the counterclaims, it's on page 48. Of the appendix, and it's clear that's not what it is. No call for the counterclaims, for a reply to the counterclaims was ever asked for. This was a response in an ongoing series of letters and setting forth what McCormick wanted done to these buildings. And the call for response is to the correspondence of July 21st and August 26th. So the idea that Mr. Lester was aware that his counterclaims, the replies to the counterclaims had not been filed, is just not so. He did not know that. He should have, but he did not know that at the time. As soon as the default judgment was brought, there was a response made, and the response presented excusable neglect, and it presented a meritorious defense based on Mr. Buckland's affidavits. And so I would respectfully ask that this court vacate what's been done here and send the case back to trial where it will be resolved on the merits one way or the other.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. The court will be in recess.